Hello and welcome to Future Tense. Anthony Fennell here with the second last in our series of summer highlight programs, the very best of the past year or so. There's a room I particularly like in the New Zealand city of Dunedin. It's in the newly refurbished Otago Settlers Museum. It's an old room, high ornate ceilings, polished wooden floors, and around the walls are hundreds of paintings and photographs, a sea of early European settlers, emotionless, stiff Victorian faces staring out into an unknown future. At first glance, the images look uniform and impenetrable. But as you begin to stare at them, you realise just how expressive they really are, that they speak of so much more than they first let on, of history and hope, of class and of struggle. Of course, the photograph has always been more than just a captured image, a simple record of times past. But has our relationship with the photo changed significantly in the digital era? That's what we're keen to explore on today's programme. Today, of course, we take, alter, crop and share photos like never before, and we use them as badges, symbols of who we are and how we feel. But haven't photographs always been as much about message as memory? UK-based naturalist Paul Evans has a theory. He reckons our modern obsession with digital capture and display links directly back to a very 19th century desire to curate the natural world.
Say, go back to Darwin. When he went off on the Beagle to discover as much about global wildlife as he possibly could, the things that he brought back had to be displayed in particular ways. So plants were collected and pressed so that they became sort of two-dimensional. Insects were collected and killed and then set into idealized forms. You know, you've seen those butterfly collections where the wings are perfectly symmetrical, and beetles where the legs are perfectly symmetrical. And I think what happened with photography is that it emerged from a similar aesthetic. And for me, the aesthetic of gathering, of capture, is a transformative thing. You take something, as it were, from the wild, and you represent it, you represent it in a different sort of way. So in your collection, in your cabinet of curiosities, in your natural history collection, you display your captives in a particular way according to a particular aesthetic. And I think with photography, more and more, what we do is to find a way of taking things from the wild and displaying them through a different sort of aesthetic, so they are transformed, they become something else.
And so in that sense, the photos that we're now taking and we're now pasting to sites like Instagram and Tumblr and Facebook, they say as much about us as they do about the images that they represent.
Yes, they do. Yeah, they're telling a really interesting story about us. And they seem to exist somewhere between inquisitiveness and acquisitiveness. You know, for 80,000 years, we were hunter-gatherers. Well, you know, a lot of people on Earth still are. And there's that very short and interesting gap between being curious about something and needing to acquire it. And I suppose it comes from, you know, finding things to eat, finding medicine, finding things that we think are valuable, that we can trade. All these things are ways of attributing value to things that we find in the environment. So our images, the things that we think of as important or beautiful or interesting or curious or provocative or challenging, are things that we say about ourselves. They're things that illustrate and bring out qualities. You know, our way of valuing things says more about ourselves than the things themselves.
And does it say something also about the way we view status our need to reassure our own status? I mean, is that what we're doing in one sense with photos? Because we tend to think of photos, that we collect photos for memory. But what you're suggesting is that that's not the whole story, is it?
No, I don't think it is. You see, I think there was a time when, in order to collect photographs, you had to be pretty wealthy. The kit for photography was very expensive. And in the days when you had to pay for things to be printed, you had to be really selective and have quite a lot of money in order to collect these things. Now, there is this wonderful sense of liberation that's happened through digital photography, where even though a lot of the kit is still pretty expensive, you can collect tons and tons and tons of images. And that sort of fits in with a kind of consumer mentality, that collecting images is a way of consuming the environment. It's a way of taking from the environment something that we want to acquire and sort of trade between us.
So following that line of thought then, there are implications, aren't there, for the way in which we experience nature and the world around us?
Yes, I think that is really important. You see signs in places that say, leave no footprints, take only photographs. Now, apart from being irritatingly smug, it's not true, is it? You can't pretend you're not there. You can't pretend that there is no effect to your presence. You can't pretend that you have no footprint, even though, you know, you may only leave the mark of a flip-flop. You can't pretend that you have no footprint in your presence anywhere anymore. And when you take a photograph, what are you actually doing? And is there a kind of a moral distinction between an image captured and the thing itself? So the thing, whether it's been observed or not, is still the thing. But when you capture an image and take it away and display it, either to yourself or to other people, what is then the relationship between the image and the thing that's hopefully still where it was? And there seems to be something really interesting going on about not just the capture of the image, but the display of the image. And when we see these images on our computers, laptops, tablets, phones, it seems to me that they're much more like the magic lanterns of 100 years ago. The image is displayed and it's seen with a kind of inner glow. You know what it's like when you look into a modern device? The image itself seems to glow, seems to radiate from the device with an inner light. And that itself seems to belong to an aesthetic which transforms whatever it was that you took a photograph of into, you know, for it to have a completely different sort of being. So you wonder, what is the relationship between the viewer and that which is being viewed? And it seems that it's rather like the difference between looking at a stained glass window, an image of a stained glass window, and, say, the butterfly on the flower outside the building. You know, there's a huge gulf, I think, widening between the image and the thing itself.
Well, I got really interested in the notion of how we walk around with cameras, you know, constantly snapping pictures and not really paying full attention to the things that we're seeing. And so what I did in this study was I had undergraduates were my participants. They went on a tour of, we have this lovely museum on our campus, the Bellarmine Museum of Art, and we took them on a guided tour of the museum. We led them around to a bunch of different objects of art, and for some of those objects of art, they would just look at it for about 30 seconds, and for some of those objects of art, they would look at it for 30 seconds, and then we'd say, now we want you to take a picture of that object. And so they walked around, and they saw a whole bunch of these pictures, half of them they took photos of, half of them they just looked at. And then the next day I brought them over to the laboratory and I asked them to try to remember which objects they had, you know, actually seen on the museum tour. And then I asked them to remember some visual details about the objects. So, you know, what color was the cape in the painting or what was this, you know, statue holding in its hands, things like that. And what I found basically was that people remembered fewer of the objects and they remembered fewer details about the objects if they had taken photos of them than the ones that they had just looked at. And so I referred to that as a photo-taking impairment effect. And it's kind of the notion that when you take pictures of things, you're kind of counting on the camera to remember for you. And because of that, you don't really engage in the kind of additional processing that would help you consolidate that experience into a more detailed memory.
That's Linda Henkel, a professor of psychology at Fairfield University in Connecticut in the United States. And as we've just heard, her recent research suggests that the way we use digital cameras acts as a form of outsourcing of memory. But as she points out, nothing's quite as straightforward as it seems.
This is something that we've done for ages. You know, I mean, it's not unique to the digital world. We used to tell our partner, oh, make sure you remember this for me, or we'd write a note to ourselves, or, you know, we'd set various reminders. But it's so ubiquitous and it's so easy that we can do these kind of outsourcings of our memories with so little thought to them, and that's what actually brings about the kind of memory deficit, because we're counting on, you know, this other thing to remember for us.
And what's also different, or what's unique about the digital age, is the sheer quantity of images we now take. I mean, people now, whereas they might have taken 10, 12, 13, 14 photos, they'll now take up to 50 if they're at an event.
Absolutely. There's virtually no cost to taking tons of pictures. Now, if you used to have to go to the store and buy film, which cost money, then you would have to use that film, then you would have to get the film developed. And, you know, I mean, each photo, you wouldn't take 10 photos of yourself making stupid faces, or here's a picture of a plate of spaghetti. You just wouldn't waste your money on things like that. And now, because it's so easy, we carry our phones around with us and take these beautiful quality pictures. We take thousands of them, and we never even look at them. We used to at least print them out and put them in photo albums, but now we just accumulate them and don't do the very thing that would help us remember things, look at the photos and think about them and actually retrieve the memories that those photos evoke. We just don't do that. And there's actually the second study that I ran in this project I wanted to just tell you about, because I actually had people zoom in on a specific feature of the object. So when I brought them around the museum for the second study, they would look at the objects, and then some of them I would just say, hey, just look at the object and now take a picture. Some of them I would say, look at the object, but I want you to zoom in on the statue's feet or zoom in on the head of the statue. And I actually found that having taken those zoomed in, very deliberate photos, your memory was as good as if you had just looked at the objects. But if you took a photo of the object as a whole, then your memory was impaired. And that's where you got the photo taking impairment effect. So I think when we think about what we're taking photos of and look at it and kind of concentrate our attentional resources on it, that can actually serve some of the functions that we're trying to do by taking these photos.
So it's an issue of concentration there, isn't it? How much concentration you put into observing what is in front of you. And the digital device helps you to, well, takes away your concentration. But when you zoom in, your brain is forced to actually take in what it is looking at, the object it's looking at.
Yeah, you're forced to take it in. So when you just take a photo of the whole object, now again, you still have to, you have to line up the shot, you have to hit the button, but it's more as if the camera is a distraction for you. When you're zooming in, and it's not about time, because I controlled for the amount of time in this, but when you zoom in, what happens is you're thinking about the object as a whole, you're focusing your attention, and it was a really interesting finding, because the feature that you zoomed in on, you not only protected your memory for the feet of the statue, but you actually were just as good as remembering the part that you didn't zoom in on. Because what the camera takes a picture of and what your brain processes are not the same things. The human mind is so much more complex than what a camera is capable of doing. So we can be looking at something, but creating a mental representation of the object as a whole. And that's very different than what a camera is capable of doing.
Your research focused on objects, not people. Is it possible that we may have less of an issue with remembering people, photographs that we take of people, as opposed to photographs we take of objects?
That's a really good question, because the human brain is uniquely designed to process information about people in a kind of different way than just about objects. We have parts of our brain that are devoted to face recognition and really, you know, looking at people's faces and thinking about people very differently. So it's quite possible that taking pictures of people rather than objects, you may not see the same effects here. I did not run that study, so I can't say if that would happen or not, but it's quite possible that you would find different results if you were taking photos of people.
So how aware are we of the role which the camera plays, the digital camera plays now in our lives and with regard to our memory?
I don't think we're as aware of it as we should be. People's ability to judge how well they're paying attention, how well they think they're going to remember things is not always very accurate. And I think a lot of what's going on is this sort of mindless use of technology. You know, we glance down at our cell phone so many times just to check messages and look at, you know, if somebody's texted us or things like that. You wouldn't even remember all those things because you're doing it in such a state of being distracted. And that kind of divided attention is a real enemy to not only experiencing things, but to later remembering those experiences. Most people say, oh, I take photos because I want to have memories of these experiences. I want to capture those memories. And if that's what you're trying to do, you're going to have to use a different strategy. If you're trying to remember these experiences, you probably need to take fewer photos, and you need to reminisce by looking at the photos. You need to look at them and organize them and talk about them and think about them, and that's what's going to benefit memory. If you're just trying to brag to your friends, look at me and the fun, fabulous life that I have, then you're taking photos for a very different reason, and the fact that you don't necessarily remember those experiences that well might not really be a problem because you're meeting different needs. You're getting social recognition. All your friends click like, or they say, oh, nice picture, and then you feel good about yourself. You know, so you might be serving different needs with the way that we've evolved to take pictures and use pictures and social media to share them. And if those are the functions, then this might be working well. But if you're really trying to capture an experience, then this mindless photography doesn't seem to be effective in doing that. You need to look at the photos after, you need to take fewer photos, and you need to concentrate while you're taking the photos and not just mindlessly walk around, there's a picture, there's a picture, there's a picture, as if they're trophies.
Linda Henkel from Fairfield University in Connecticut, and before her, British naturalist and writer Dr. Paul Evans. I'm Anthony Fennell, and this is Future Tense. And by the way, there's a very nice photo of me on our website. Why don't you check it out? Just search the words RN and Future Tense, and you're sure to find it. And if you like it, why not reaffirm my sense of self-worth with a tweet? RN Future Tense is our handle on Twitter.
If you just think of sort of digital media in broader terms, the most successful digital media / social networks, they actually capitalize and amplify behavior that already exists. You never hear about a new social media site or a new app that's creating totally new behavior. If you think about it, Twitter is really a cocktail conversation, and networking just at an insanely amplified level. Facebook is what people would normally do on a one-to-one level, but it's done on a massive scale. So what Instagram is doing is taking our love for nostalgia and just making it instantly accessible and instantly publishable on a massive scale.
David Yoon is a photographer, app developer, and the founder of the user experience and product design company Yoonco. And like me, he's fascinated by the whole Instagram photo filter craze. Why so many people would want to use a digital platform to alter their photos and make their snapshots look older than they actually are, in some cases making them look really old, well, I'm not really sure what that's all about, to be honest. But David Yoon has a hunch. He thinks there's a very human need that's being fed by the fake nostalgia fad.
It's a reaction to modernity. It's a reaction to mass production. This is just my personal theory, but I think there's so much sameness in the world. And when you go to your big box stores and you see everything is brand new, everything is uniform, it's mass produced, we actually crave something that has a little bit of personality to it, that gives it character, that mimics something we'd find in nature. When you see an old tree, it's obviously old. It's weathered. It's dried out in places. It's cracked. When you see an old house, it has those signs of age that show experience and personality and evidence of life. And when you go to a big box store or you buy something off the internet that's been mass produced, it doesn't have that halo around it that indicates that it is part of life. So, you know, I had a friend who bought a brand new iPad, and he very happily began scratching it up on every surface he could find. And I was like, aren't you worried that it's getting scratched up? And he said, no, it gives it character.
Is there a sense of, with the use of a photo filter, of giving a photo a feeling of place and time, a feeling of history that it doesn't otherwise have? Is there a restoration of historical place and time going on here?
I think so. I think that's exactly what's happening. It's a bit of historicity where the photo that you just took an instant ago becomes part of, you know, the photographic canon of your life. You want to give it a sense of place and time. And the fact that a digital photograph taken 5 years ago pretty much looks like it does now, who knows, maybe in future formats we'll have obvious cues that make it seem obvious, you know, when the photo was taken. If you see digital photographs from the very early days of digital cameras, you can tell, oh, that was taken in the early 90s. But as digital cameras get better and better, it's getting harder and harder to tell when exactly photos were taken. But I think the other aspect of Instagram filters is that it turns your everyday mundane scenery into something interesting. It gives it almost like this epic quality. So if you take a photo of your cappuccino foam and run it through a filter, suddenly what was a very, you know, throwaway, ordinary photograph becomes worthy of sharing and commenting on and liking and favoriting and so on and so forth. So I do think it gives it the appearance of being from a certain point in time in history, but I think also selfishly, as a photographer, it makes it easy to add a wow factor to your photos. The implications from memory is it makes it shorter. There could wind up being a greater nostalgia for things that happened relatively shortly ago. That latency between when you actually experience something and, you know, time passes, and then you start to feel nostalgic for that time, that experience. I think that period might be shortening since our memories are so closely tied with digital documentation and digital publishing and sharing that normally you would feel nostalgic about a photo taken 10 years ago. But now I think it's easier to feel nostalgic about a photo that was taken a year ago, maybe 6 months ago.
Here's how you can relive a good time over and over again. See it, big as life, in full color slides. The newest, smartest way to take color slides is with a stylish Kodak Signet 40 camera. You'll wear it proudly everywhere you go. Just aim, focus, snap. It's as easy as that. Exciting action shots.
The question as to whether the digital world, the fact that we can spread these images around to potentially much larger networks of people, does that shift the nature of how we think of ourselves, of how we project ourselves, if you like, when that photo is being taken of us?
David White has our final perspective today. He's the manager of the Technology-Assisted Lifelong Learning Research and Development Group at Oxford University, and he's curious about the dynamics of digital distribution.
Now, you could argue that when that family snapshot was being taken that was only going to end up in the album that the family saw or friends saw, that is still a kind of performance. You know, most people, when they take family photos, they choose a moment that's happy, when everybody is getting along with each other. You rarely see family photos of people being angry or miserable. So in that sense, it was always a highly curated sort of piece of identity. So even if the audience was fairly tight, even if the audience was a very known group with a traditional physical photograph, there was still an element of performance there. I think that what happens now is that we understand that because that photograph, once it goes online, we lose control of it in perhaps a way that we wouldn't have done when it went into a physical album. So I think that one of the things that happens in terms of how authentic that moment is that we want to control our identity, we want to control our image. And one of the things that I see a lot is that somebody will take a photograph, and then the person who's had the photograph taken will demand to look at that photo because they can, because it's instant. And they'll take a look on the little screen on the back of the camera and they'll go, no, I don't think that one's good enough. I don't feel that really looks like me. I don't think that reflects me in a good light. Can you delete it and take it again? So I'm not sure whether the performance has become any more or less synthetic, but I think our need to control it and our ability to control it has increased. Mainly, we want to do that because we know once that photo is posted somewhere online, it's gone. We can't get that back.
So that ability of the person who's being photographed to, in a sense, curate what is being taken, that really does change the dynamic, doesn't it, between the photographer, you like, and the subject?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that dynamic, as you say, between the photographer and the subject has changed when the subject's a person. I think this is in a large part where the motivation for the selfie comes along. So these are photographs where you see people holding out their phone or their camera and taking a picture just of their own face in a context. And part of the reason for a selfie is to say, I was here, I was part of this moment, to share that with people that they know online. But I also think one of the reasons that the selfie is so popular is because it's one of the few times when you can totally control your own image. So you don't have that awkward moment with the photographer where you have to say, actually, I don't look very good in that photo. Can you delete that? I really would prefer it if you didn't post that anywhere. Can we try again? With the selfie, you have control and you can take it again and again until you're comfortable that you're projecting a version of yourself that you're happy with. And I think that's as much to do with control as it is to do with vanity.
We're used to the idea, I guess, there was a traditional sort of idea, if you like, that photos were important for memory, assisting our memory of events that we had taken part in or of places that we had visited, people that we had met. Is that connection between photos and memory, is that overstated in the modern world? Is that still there in the modern world? Because it's, again, from what you and other people have said, it's very much also about performance in a way, isn't it? It's about personal portrayal.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I think that this is something that has shifted because of the all-pervasive nature of these devices that allow us to take images, okay, whether that's of ourselves, of others, of places, of moments. And I think that what's happened is that we have, in some senses, offset our memory into these devices. There was an advert on the television in the UK recently, and it said, "Today I saved the life of my daughters." And the actual product on sale was a digital camera. And what the advert was saying was that you need to capture images. You need to capture those images of those moments in your life. Otherwise, you won't have your life. Do you see what I mean? Your life is becoming those digital artifacts. And if you don't create them, did that moment really happen? Is that moment really authentic? Are we sort of getting to the point whereby unless we capture something, it never happened? Unless we share it, unless we get that response back from social media, it wasn't authentic. It didn't happen. Now, of course, there's all sorts of dangers there, which is that we spend such a lot of time capturing because we can. Somehow we're not actually living that moment, but we're one step removed from it. And so I think that memory has shifted almost, if you like, out of our brains and into these devices. And one thing that fascinates me is people who are capturing media images that they never ever view. They never go back to look at them. They're just sat there as a certain amount of megabytes on a storage device. And I think of these as like orphaned memories, okay? So what's important is the moment of capture, that we've chosen to capture that event as a digital artifact, as an image. Is it important that we go back and look at it again? That's questionable. But it's certainly shifted from when we take those photographs of the sort of family picnic or of the wedding, of these rites of passage, of these particular moments of the first day of school. These were real kind of milestones in people's lives that we were using to hold on to this sort of timeline of memories. I think now it's much more of a flow. But it's very much to do with the idea that an event needs to be captured, even if it doesn't need to be reviewed, to be seen or to be thought of as authentic.
David White there from Oxford University. Our other guests were David Yoon, Paul Evans and Linda Henkel. Andrew Davies is my Future Tense co-producer. The sound engineer this week was Jim Usher. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next week, cheers.
Meet the ABC Radio app. It gives you access to RN on your phone, along with 19 other ABC radio networks, including local radio, news radio, Classic FM, Triple J, and all our digital-only stations. The ABC Radio app also has program schedules, links to our current ABC emergency coverage. It's free. Download it by searching ABC Radio app and take ABC Radio with you on your phone.